I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Our guest today is author Mecca Jamila Sullivan.
And her first book just came out. It's a collection of stories, quite beautiful, called Blue Talk and Love. And we're going to talk to Mecca about this book, how it came about.
So stick around.
She's a very interesting woman.
Yeah.
Do you know, I met her many, many years ago. I was a professor here at UTEP, and I got this email from Temple University, the creative writing program, and they asked me if I'd be willing to come and do a reading.
Nice.
And so I said, sure, of course I would. And
of course.
I'd never been to Philadelphia before. I'd never been to Temple before. So I went, and I found out that the reason why they invited me was because of Mecca.
Wow.
She was a graduate student. She was graduating, doing her thesis. And apparently, when you're – I don't know if they do this for all students, but they do it for some of the students. They allow you to choose a writer, any writer you want, and they invite them, and then you read with them.
That's awesome.
And for some weird reason, she chose me.
For some strange reason.
It's a really strange reason. Because she could have had anyone in the world because their budget was $20,000.
Right.
Okay, now I'm lying.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I figured.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if she could have brought somebody like, you know, Toni Morrison or –
he would have been the last
Sal Rushdie. Yeah, but they brought me. I had just come out with a novel. It was my very first novel. I was a very new writer.
And the shadows took him.
But have you ever been to Philadelphia?
No, never have.
I had never been before either, and I was wondering if somebody was going to pick me up at the airport, and they said, well, just take the train. And I thought, wow, that's so rude. And I realized when I got there, I saw that Philadelphia is not the kind of city where you pick people up at the airport. I mean, it's like New
everybody
York.
Everybody was taking the train.
Yeah. You take the train everywhere. You take, you know. And I was there for two nights. I did the reading. The graduate students were great. They took me out to eat, and it was just a really nice time.
That's good.
But I had been all over the world. I had been to Europe. I had been to Latin America. I had been to so many different places. I had been to Asia. But I had never been to New York City.
Oh, really? So at that time, you had not been to New York City?
I had never been to New York City.
Oh, wow.
So what I did was I canceled my – I changed my plane, and I spent 4 days in New York City. It was I remember the first – I took the train from Philadelphia to New York City. I remember seeing the city. I was just – I got chills. And then you go underground, and then you end up in Grand Central Station.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. 4 days just walking around the city with absolutely no plans. It was
– God, that's great.
And I have – I've heard a thank for that. I should thank her.
You should thank her. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'll do it in a note. Have you ever been to New York? You obviously been to New York many times.
I have. And my experience was the same, except that I didn't have 4 days to just roam. I actually had like things to do, and it was really compact. So it was like I got there. Probably the most exciting moment I had to myself was entering New York City for the first time. It was on a train also coming from Vermont, actually from Albany. And I came in, and sure enough, you see the city open up, and it's, you know, what surprised me was how green that city is. I guess in my mind, you know, coming from the West Coast, it was like, it's all concrete, but it was so green and so beautiful. And it was everything it was kind of what I had in my mind. I had envisioned. So that was the moment. And after that, it was just like one thing after the other. So I didn't, next thing I knew, I was in an airplane flying back to California.
Well, you know, that was the cool thing about it. Do you know the poet Patrick Rosal?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He lived right outside of the city, and we had a mutual friend, and the mutual friend said, can I stay? You know, asked if I could stay. So I stayed with Pat.
Oh, wow.
And on the third night, Pat took me to Manhattan, and he does these readings in these clubs, and he is like so popular. When he walks in, everyone goes, oh, Pat's here, Pat's here. And everybody had to wait, but they brought him up right away, and he just did this killer reading about his cousin in prison, his cousin, this hip-hop guy who's so big but doesn't really know how big he is, and it's just really a beautiful poem. And after that, he took me to a party. I think it was Midtown. It was a high-rise. It was the most beautiful view I had ever seen. It was just like in the movies, and it was all writers, and I was just sitting there just stunned. At
All writers in a high-rise, huh?
All writers and me. Yes.
Wow.
But it was a cool experience. Been back several times since, as I know you have.
I think so, yeah.
And I'll probably go again.
Nice. And you have Mecca.
I have Mecca to thank you. Thank you, Mecca. So stick around, and we're going to talk to the one responsible for bringing me to New York City, but more importantly, the one responsible for this beautiful book called
Blue
Talk and Love.
Blue Talk and Love is the brand new collection of short stories by author Mecca Jamila Sullivan, who currently lives and teaches in Amherst. Her work has been published in numerous anthologies and journals, including Callaloo, Best New Writing, Prairie Schooner, and many others. She is also the recipient of the Charles Johnson Award for Fiction, and her work has been honored by the National Endowment for the Arts. Of her book, Blue Talk and Love, author Rick Moody draws comparisons to William Faulkner and calls her book frankly contemporary and paradoxically lyrical. Mecca Jamila Sullivan, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations on your book, Blue Talk and Love.
Yes.
It just came out, and dang, this is a beautiful book.
It is. It's a strong book.
Thank you. That means a lot coming from you. I appreciate that.
So this is your first book.
It is. Very first one.
Nice. What a strong debut also. It's just fantastic, tightly written book. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So how did this book come about? Tell us from the beginning to the end.
Sure. Well, it's a long story about short stories.
I like that. It's a long story about short stories. I might steal that someday.
That might be the next tagline.
Hey. You know, these stories have been, some of them have been in the works, you know, for a few years, actually. The oldest one, I think, is Powder and Smoke, which is a story. It's a kind of updated, rewritten version of a story that I drafted as an undergraduate at Smith College years ago.
Wow.
So, and then, of course, the more recent stories, you know, I just started working on, you know, a little over a year ago. So, you know, they all kind of have their own sort of backstory, their own trajectory. But, you know, I think sort of generally what brings them together has been an interest in really kind of thinking through the voices and kind of inner worlds of characters whose inner worlds we don't often see. Well, and that's something that's always been important to me as a writer.
Right. Were any of these stories written when you were a student at Temple?
You know, a couple of them I did workshop at Temple, yeah. Snowfight, the one, in fact, that I read when you and I had the chance to read together.
Oh, that's why it was familiar.
Snowfight,
right.
Yeah, you know, in a very kind of updated form. I spent a lot of time, you know how this goes, I spent a lot of time kind of rewriting and reimagining.
Right.
But it's been great to spend you know, a couple of years off and on with different stories and to see how they connect with the newer stories in the collection. Right.
Well, Wolfpack is certainly a very powerful story. It opens up the book, and apparently it's based on a true story. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired this story, about the incident that inspired it?
Sure, absolutely. So it's based on the story of the New Jersey Four, which, you know, is a group of four friends basically from New Jersey who in 2006, in the summer of 2006, were spending some time in the West Village hanging out, you know, and they ended up in a kind of verbal confrontation with a man on the, you know, who was sort of hanging out on the street. The verbal confrontation got physical. There were sort of rape threats, and it became, you know, again, a kind of physical altercation. There were seven women altogether. Four of them were charged with felony gang assault of this man. And, you know, what struck me about the case was there was not a ton of evidence, right? A lot of the kind of testimony you can see is, you know, more or less, you know, hearsay and kind of, you know, inconclusive. But something that really struck me about that case was the way that kind of dehumanizing languages were circulating at almost every level of the case in terms of talking about these women and their bodies. So, you know, during the actual verbal interaction, you know, the man calls one of the women an elephant. And then in the court testimony, you hear, or rather in the sentencing, one of the judges kind of, you know, bits of advice for them in the sentencing is, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, right? This idea that, you know, you should sort of endure whatever kind of verbal violence, right, or linguistic violence. And they, of course, are sort of, you know, blamed for the escalation to a more physical interaction. And then in the media coverage, I mean, that the title comes from, in fact, a news headline where the women are referred to as wolves. They're referred to as a wolf pack. They're referred to as killer lesbians.
Wow.
When we're talking about, you know, young women who are 19, 20, 21 years old, right, who are just kind of hanging out, looking for a kind of queer social space. And, of course, you know, what they get is lots and lots of jail time. They were sentenced from 6 months in prison to 11 years in prison. And the woman who received that 11-year sentence, she was 19 at the time.
Wow. And he was saying not only dehumanizing terms, but he was also being very misogynistic and homophobic.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. Right. So, I mean, right, one of the most sort of interesting kind of pivotal moments in my research of the case is sort of the moment where he's threatening to rape them, almost like it's a kind of a threat of a kind of corrective rape, right? You know, something that we hear about a lot in thinking about LGBT experience, and yet we don't often associate that with, you know, New York City in 2006, right? I mean, we think of that as something that happens to someone else somewhere else. and yet it was very present for this community.
Right. And, you know, actually just the other day, I heard one of our professors here at UTEP, Luis Arturo Ramos, say to a student, you know, we should read fiction as if it were history and read history as if it were fiction.
Wow.
And, you know, that sort of blurring that line between, you know, fiction and the actual. And your book, especially this story, Wolfpack, you know, I thought of that immediately. And I'm curious, though, as to, you know, how much of the story did you actually just pull from newspapers, or did you actually sort of dig deeper and do more research and, or even go as far as interviewing some of the women? Was that any of that involved? Or?
So that's interesting. First of all, that axiom of, you know, reading history as fiction and fiction as history, that is brilliant, and I have to use that.
Right.
But, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was inspired by news headlines, and so I started with the news stories, you know, and then I started to dig a little bit deeper and, you know, read whatever sort of court documents were publicly available. Interestingly, I didn't have the chance to meet any of these, you know, these women themselves were in prison at the time that I was writing the story. So I didn't have the chance to meet them until much more recently. I got to meet a few of them, Patrice Johnson and Renata Hill, and, you know, got to share the story with them, which was, of course, an incredibly kind of gratifying, you know, experience, just, you know, on a kind of personal and kind of activist level. And so there's been a film that's kind of doing the circuit now called Out in the Night that's about their experience.
Oh,
and
wow.
So they're, yeah, and it's a really great film.
That's great.
You should definitely check it out. It's, you know, there has been a kind of right blending of, you know, the fictional and the kind of real. A lot of the dialogue, a lot of the dialogue does come from some headlines and from court documents.
I know when artists try to draw or paint a person, no matter how beautiful the work is, the people say, that doesn't look like me. Were there any of those kind of protests about this thing? No, that's not what we did. Or
that's right.
Like that.
Right.
You know, yeah, I was prepared for that. But no, actually, I mean, you know, this is the type of thing that's, you know, you kind of live for as an artist, where you write something that's inspired by somebody's story and, you know, you sort of share it with them. And what you hope for is that they'll find something of value in it. And I think that's exactly what happened, you know.
Right.
So if they did feel like, oh, that wasn't what really happened, or this isn't how I really felt, no one has said that to me. Now, that said, I mean, you know, as a fiction writer, I don't strive to sort of recreate reality, right? What I'm trying to do is kind of highlight certain aspects of the truth that I find, you know, important. And I think the kind of questions around language that circulated throughout that case, that's really what was of interest to me. And I think that the women that I've spoken to, I think, feel comfortable with how I rendered that, which means everything to me.
Right, which is a big responsibility, because you actually do it from the first person, you know, and it's so compelling and believable. That's why I had to ask you if you had interviewed them, because it's entirely believable.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I had a writing teacher tell me years ago that you can't possibly use multiple first-person perspectives in a short story. And so I thought, well, I know exactly what I'm going to do in my next story.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, right.
And that was just before I started drafting this story, and it was important to me to kind of, you know, get the multiplicity of voices, you know, because I think in some ways capturing the multiplicity of voices is a way of showing the complexity of a set of lives, right? That, like, we are not, in fact, animals. There's a human complexity here, and you know, using this many voices, using these different styles, is a way of kind of asking the reader to consider that and really kind of forcing them to wrestle with that.
Right.
Well, the multiple perspectives in the story certainly made sense, but one of the things I noticed about the other stories is quite a few of them have multiple perspectives. They tell the story from one perspective, and then it switches to another. And I'm wondering if you do that for a particular reason, or are you just following the language, or how does that come about? Because it does seem to be a motif, for lack of a better word, in your work, or a technique that you often use. Let's put it that way.
Right, right. No, I do. Yeah, I do see it that way, as both a motif and a technique. And certainly, I think part of that is just I'm definitely a writer who's drawn to voice, and I find voice to be a very useful way into a story, but also into a social world. And I do feel pretty strongly that our voices reflect who we are, reflect our experiences. And again, for me, it's about this question of, you know, kind of subjectivity, multiplicity, complexity, that, you know, the nuances of your voice express the nuances of who you are, right? That it's very difficult to be a kind of static, monolithic character if you've got a kind of rich, complex voice, right? Complexities are going to kind of come through. And so for me, using multiple perspectives to tell a given story just shows the complexity of the story. And I think that that's always my objective in fiction.
Yeah, and one of the things about this book is the voices. They're very believable, and the language is oftentimes just beautiful. And but also it seems to work on a kind of a thematic level as well, that really this book is not about one person. It's about a community.
That's great. Thank you. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I love the idea of a collection of short stories as, you know, kind of simulating or creating a community. I think that that's, in some ways, that's what short story collections all strive to do, right? To kind of create worlds that are connected and show the connections between them.
Yeah, we got Winesburg, Ohio, which represents a community. And a lot of these stories are centered in Harlem and with the LGBT community. And there's a lot of Latinos in here.
That's right. Yeah.
How did that come about? And your Spanish is pretty good, by the way.
Yeah. Better than mine, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a New Yorker, and I grew up in Harlem, kind of, you know, northwest edge of Harlem, right between Harlem and Washington Heights. It's a small neighborhood in Harlem called Hamilton Heights, where there was there've been a kind of set of shifts, right, as happens in Harlem and in you know, sort of urban spaces throughout the country. But, you know, I grew up hearing lots of languages, primary among them English and Spanish. And, you know, even before my family moved to Harlem, my family moved up there when I was six. But before that, I was living on the Lower East Side. Mm. And so also heard a lot of Spanish, right? Sort of Puerto Rican Spanish at first, and then Dominican Spanish uptown. And, you know, maybe I think this may probably sort of comes into my kind of relationship with voice and my fascination with voice. I love language, and I can't not sort of think about multiple languages when I think about the community that I grew up in. I would have to force myself, put it this way, I think I'd have to work pretty hard, right, to not think and write in at least a few different languages.
That's a beautiful statement. It reminds me of that criticism, that movie Boyhood, which takes place in part cities in Texas, which, you know, are almost, you know, some of them are majority Latinos, and you cannot avoid hearing Spanish. You cannot avoid hanging out with us Mexicans. But this film, actually, there were none whatsoever in the landscape, and there was some criticism on that. But I think it's really important that we represent our communities the way that they are, and yours definitely does that.
Yeah, and I think, too, I mean, you know, when we think about the way that, you know, Black and Latino communities exist in this country, there's so much kind of, you know, collaboration. There are interesting kind of social relationships. And, you know, I think that's, especially as a New Yorker, again, that's a part of New York experience that, you know, many people sort of live and not enough people write about. And I think, you know, it was important to me to make sure that some of that is kind of documented and put out there, that the relationships between Black communities and Latino communities are strong, are, you know, sort of complex and have deep histories, deep and kind of vibrant living histories.
We are speaking with author Mecca Jamila Sullivan about her new book, fantastic new collection of short stories called Blue Talk and Love, out with Riverdale Avenue Books. Mecca, one of the things that I was obviously is very apparent in all the stories is there's so much love in these stories and in the characters and in their lives. I mean, it's in the title also, Blue Talk and Love. I sort of instantly thought of the Sufi poet Rumi, who said, and I'm totally going to paraphrase and mess this up, I'm not as eloquent as Rumi was, but, you know, everything is about love, running toward it or running away from it.
Wow.
You know, and obviously there's a very political, the stories are political by their content and the subject. And I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about where you see those two things, those two intersect in your work, love and the political.
Well, that's fantastic. You know, it's interesting. So thinking about Rumi in that context, it actually leads me to think about Audre Lorde, sort of her similar interest in what's political about love vis-a-vis the erotic, sort of, you know, the connections between sexuality and political work, or, you know, erotic connection and political kind of activism and collaboration. And I think in both cases, both what Lorde and Rumi are saying is that thinking through, you know, sort of feelings and accessing sort of, you know, pleasurable feelings that are forged in communication and in connection with other people really promotes a kind of political vision, right? It can animate our political vision. It can help us understand how to do the kind of political work that we want to do. It can help us envision the kinds of futures that we want to live in. And I think that's absolutely what motivates not only me, actually, in my writing, but I think in my characters. I think my characters are often kind of working through trying to understand how they're read, what's expected of them in a social world, and how to redefine those spaces. And a lot of times the way they do that is through, you know, loving, romantic, sexual, you know, other kinds of pleasurable connections with people like them or not like them.
Right.
And, you know, that's something that I think I also kind of strive for, you know, in my, in whatever activist work that I do beyond my writing as well, really kind of thinking about how connection, interpersonal connection, the, you know, the emotional,
right,
and kind of do good work on a political sphere as well.
Speaking of love, let's talk about Blue Talk and Love, the title story, which is the second story in the book, and it's about Xiomara. Am I saying the name correct? Xiomara and Ernestine, two young women, and there's kind of this duality that not just in this story, but seems to come in a lot of other stories where there's one young woman or one woman who's kind of awkward and not very pretty, and then the other one who's very pretty and very smooth, and you seem to have this dichotomy in a lot of the stories. Is this a metaphor that's important to you?
You know, that's interesting. I think that that kind of dichotomy, as you put it, is important to me in as much as, you know, I'm really interested in sort of seeking out and exposing beauty in unexpected places.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
That makes sense.
And really kind of challenging what we think of as beauty and how we understand beauty working. And so I think that's definitely what that story is trying to do, that thinking about how the main character, Ernestine, you know, sees Xiomara as this kind of icon of beauty in her junior high school. And, you know, the character is, you know, Xiomara is accepted as the pretty girl. But sort of through her interactions with Xiomara and sort of understanding her feelings, her admiration, her kind of fear, her intimidation, her disgust, her desire for Xiomara, Ernestine kind of comes to really sort of rethink what beauty is and what beauty does and, you know, begins to sort of imagine herself engaging with beauty in different ways and maybe even seeing herself as being potentially beautiful. And the story also tries to think about how beauty itself can be painful and how having that kind of that beauty ascribed to you limits the ways in which you are able to be a full, complex human being, you know, and sort of elide some of your own personal desires and your own sort of capacity for choice.
Yeah, and speaking of the complexity of Ernestine, and I love the names. The names themselves really represent
throughout the book,
the characters. Exactly, you know, Ernestine, would you rather be an Ernestine or a Xiomara?
Right. But
Ernestine's father, who's a musician, he talks to her and he says, you know, you got duende. Yeah, that's what you got. Right. You got this duende about you. And of course, you know, as writers, we know a little bit about where the term duende comes from or what it means to us. But it certainly gives her a depth of character that not a lot of people have. Can you explain why you chose duende and what duende means to you in relation to this story and even just as an artistic term?
Sure. So, you know, it's a term that I think in some ways I knew that it needed to kind of come up in the title story. Because, you know, in some ways that it's a notion that kind of runs throughout all of the all of the stories, this idea of sort of beauty that encompasses a kind of longing and pain. You know, I mean, I think about it sort of through, you know, Lorca's notion of duende, but I think, you know, what I'm also trying to get at with it is this idea that it is also sort of, you know, closely related to this idea of soul. You know, I think part of that is about a kind of, you know, drawing up the connections between African diaspora cultures, right? That, like, there is a way to think about the pain and longing of duende and the kind of the ways in which duende can also animate, again, sort of action, right, and sort of characterize one's relationship to the world. And that soul kind of does the same thing. It can be, you know, very generative, right, of kind of creative work. Soul food, soul music, right?
Right.
And I think that the same is true of duende. And yet, you know, I also was interested in thinking about the fetishization of, you know, sort of Spanish language and sort of Latin American culture, how even for someone like Ernestine, hearing a term that is very familiar to her, like soul, is less exciting for her than thinking about duendes. You know, my characters are also pretty much, they're sort of complexly involved, I think, in a lot of the kind of social hierarchies that we set up in contemporary culture. So she is a little bit kind of fetishizing and maybe sort of exoticizing this word, but she's also connecting with it on a very kind of profound level, and it's what pushes her forward through this journey with herself, with her body, and with her desire.
You know, my friends and I jokingly use the term duende to mean anything that just kind of got like soul, like you said. And so we'll say, like, for example, if we go to a bad party, it's really boring, we'll say that host has no party duende.
That's so good.
No party duende.
You know,
that's so good.
Yeah. Blue Talk and Love, the title of that story and the title of the book comes from a song by Earth, Wind & Fire, one of my favorite songs, by the way, September. And it goes, only blue talking love, remember, happy new love was here to stay.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and music
you're
is throughout.
Oh,
thank you. Thank you.
don't encourage him.
Okay.
And you have music throughout, not only in your language, the language itself, which is very musical at times, but a lot of the characters are musicians, and they're, you know, a lot of them just have these, you know, like Alvaro in that story. What's the name of that story? Ruidos, yeah, which is really fantastic story. He's kind of like this musician who just can't play anymore. And, you know, and he's certainly got, if we want to use the term duende, he certainly has it.
Yes.
How does music play within your approach to art?
Yeah, that's totally central. I mean, music, I'm the type of person who, you know, I don't do very much without music. I mean, most of the activities that I experience in my day, they have a soundtrack. You know, I'm always listening to music. I've got, like, my dream is to have, like, a full stereo setup in the bathroom in whatever, you know, whatever house I buy.
Yes.
So that I can make sure I always have, you know, all my music on deck. So it is really important to me and to my work. You know, I think you're right. I mean, I agree that I think, you know, music and this notion of duende or sort of the beauty of longing and the possibility of pain, I think music can articulate those connections in ways, you know, that are necessary and are important. Also, part of it does come from, again, growing up in Harlem where, you know, my sort of auditory experience, you know, from on a kind of day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis, always involved hearing, you know, someone playing, you know, hip-hop on the stoop, and then a car, you know, drives by blasting some merengue, and then somebody walks by singing, you know, old doo-wop song.
Yeah,
and that's sort of the soundscape I grew up in.
And then the first sirens of the day, I think I'm quoting you on one of the stories. I love that detail, you know, this morning, the first sirens of the day. That's from Ruidos as well. Yeah, all this noise making music.
We have been speaking with author Mecca Jamila Sullivan about her new collection of stories, Blue Talk and Love, out on Riverdale Avenue Books. So be sure to pick that up. Mecca, thank you so much.
Thank you. Such a pleasure talking with you.
We'd like to thank author Mecca Jamila Sullivan, whose collection of stories, Blue Talk and Love, was just released by Riverdale Avenue Books. So be sure to pick that up.
It's a beautiful book, and the language is so beautiful, and the stories are so wonderful. I'm thinking, my God, that's why I'm a writer.
Yeah, it's a strong debut collection, that's for sure.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget,
the next book you read,
you know, I think we've been saying that for too long. It may save your life. Let's come up with something else, Tim. Let's find a really cool way to end the show. If anybody has any ideas, email us at our UTEP email addresses. You can find us, Google us very easily. I don't know, maybe a quote from Rumi or something.
Oh, that's good,
We'll figure something out.
We're open.
Next time we have a show, we're going to have a new closing. But for now, they really may save your life.